For the week of March 22nd, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 274, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
You know, I know you're in New York, Michael, because I have meerkat. I also know it's snowing in New York, but that's beside the point.
Meerkats are adorable. What does that have to do with snowing in New York?
Well, first of all, I'm a little surprised that it's still snowing in New York. It snowed like nonstop this winter. And it's springtime now as of Friday. But yet there's this new app started in, it launched in January for the iPhone and was a big hit at South by Southwest, which is kind of coming to an end this week. And it's this, it gives you the ability to broadcast live video from your phone. And so I started watching all these streams from New York.
What do you mean broadcast live? Onto a Meerkat website or?
No, right to other people's phones.
And you mean if they follow you, they can see it?
Yes.
Does it get stored somewhere?
No. It's actually, you know, they basically say, look, it's live and then it's gone, which is their way of saying, we don't want to store all of your darn video.
And can you record it while you're doing it on your own?
I think you can record it to your phone. Like you can download it to your phone, but that's it. You can't.
And you think that's going to revolutionize journalism?
I think, imagine what it would have been like in Ferguson and St. Louis during the Arab Spring during 2011. It would have been interesting. You would have had live video.
It'll give Brian Williams something to do.
Oh, my goodness. See a couple of episodes ago for what we're talking about.
Or just any newspaper in the world. Why do they have to go back a few episodes on Showbiz Sandbox?
I'm trying to keep them internal.
All right.
I'm trying not to send them off to other news sources.
Well, tell them about this week's show, keeping them really internal.
Well, on today's show, we're going to be talking about money. Because after all, they don't call it show business for nothing. Money and the entertainment industry go together like Laurel and Hardy, Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd, or Asterix and Obelix. Names I always have trouble pronouncing, but, you know, if you're not from the U.S., there's a, you know, what, they're from Belgium, right?
Yes, keep going.
Okay, well, yet, you know, when money and entertainment mix, Michael, as you know from, say, last week's episode, it's not unusual for lawsuits to spring up from arguments over what at times can be enormous profits. Take, for example, the dispute over whether digital music is sold or licensed. Universal Music looks like it will be the final major label to settle lawsuits over this long-standing battle about digital sales. We'll explain what all this means a little later. Then there's the television networks, which for at least the last 5 years have been worrying about cord cutting. Well, cord cutting is finally happening, which means the death of television networks. Except that it's not, and it doesn't. We'll tell you what we mean and why everyone else is wrong about cord cutting on Inside Baseball. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on where our wives, girlfriends, and daughters were over the weekend.
That's right. We're talking about the worldwide box office, and women are dominating the box office in the first quarter of 2015, as they have been for quite a while. And the number one movie fitting in with that theme is Insurgent, the new episode of the Divergent series.
Installment episode.
It grossed $101 million worldwide. That's almost its budget, which is about $110 million, according to some people. So that's a good launch to the movie, or is it?
I think, it's how many territories is it in?
It's in a lot. It's in 77 territories.
Well, if it can triple that over the next 4 weeks, then yes.
Well, here's why we're talking about it. They were teasing part two, and I kind of thought they were lucky to get away with Divergent not losing money. And I thought, gee, I don't know if I'd continue the series. I might have just walked away from it.
You would have been wrong.
Huh?
You would have been wrong. Not necessarily.
No, not yet. I'm not sure that I'm wrong, but they said, oh, no, not only are we making the series, but we're going to turn the third book into two movies because they just want to annoy everybody. So Divergent 2, Insurgent is out, and they kept teasing it over the last week and a half. Oh, it's going to be bigger than the first one. It's going to be bigger than the first one in North America. And you're like, well, of course it should be because everybody saw the first movie. It's a front-loaded type of event film, which means the sequel should be bigger than the first one, assuming it worked. And in fact, they were wrong, and the sequel came in lower than the original movie, which is a very bad sign for the film's popularity in North America. Now, the studio immediately said, oh, but don't worry. just like we do it here at Showbiz Sandbox, they said worldwide box office is going to save us. We're thrilled with the movie. It's doing great overseas. It's pacing far ahead of the first film. And if the dollar wasn't so strong, we'd be making even more money. So this is the second movie in a while now that they've been talking about it, the fact that the strong dollar is really depressing overseas box office. And since overseas box office is where the majority of their ticket sales now come from, of course, it's where most of the people in the world live, that's a big factor for Hollywood. So they say overseas is going to save the movie. It's doing better market to market than the first movie did. So they introduced the series and people are excited to see the sequel. But we'll have to see what the legs are. And the fact that it opened lower than the first one in North America tells me people just do not care about this movie.
Well, I think 60% of those seeing it here were women. I don't know that people don't care about it. I just think
saying it's not a successful series. You want the second one to build on the first. If it was like The Hunger Games, the second one did a lot better than the first in North America.
What about the Twilight series? Did the second one do better than the first?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and that was a film where this movie is hoping for that pattern. Twilight was not as well known overseas. They introduced the series in the first film and then it grew a lot overseas with the second film. So that's what they're hoping to see here. It could happen. We're glad to see the focus on worldwide box office. The dollar is an interesting factor, but women perhaps are the biggest story of all. And that takes us to our number two movie around the world. It's Cinderella, the Kenneth Branagh, you know, live action spin on the fairy tale. It's for Disney. It grossed $75 million over the weekend. It's now at $250 million worldwide. So that is proving a very successful idea for Disney, live action versions of their classic fairy tales. And it points to the fact that women are dominating box office, aren't they?
Yes, well, that's the second out of three. I mean, because you had 50 Shades of Grey as well, which I think we can assume, or actually no, it's been reported that it's 67% female audience for that particular movie.
Is that on opening weekend or overall? Or I think that was opening weekend.
That was opening weekend, yes.
And it probably remained that way. Yeah, well, yes.
And so, then, of course, there's all the films that people are pointing to, and by people, I mean the media is pointing to as, well, these are male-driven films that have failed. Jupiter Ascending, Seventh Son, Hot Tub Time Machine 2. Except for Hot Tub Time Machine 2, Jupiter Ascending and Seventh Son were set up to be, not failures, but they were being released in January, February. Seventh Son had been sitting on the shelf for years, so it wasn't
a good movie.
I mean, I just think these weren't very good movies. So forget about the fact that it's male or female driven. Those aren't good movies.
Well, yes, but they're released in January, February, March and flopping, whereas these other movies are released in January, February, March and succeeding.
True.
So you don't, there's no time of year that you can say, oh, a movie's released in January, therefore it doesn't count. No, there's no reason any movie shouldn't make money at any time of the year. But the fact is that Insurgent opening weekend audience was 60% female. The opening weekend crowd for 50 Shades of Grey was 57% female.
67%.
Yeah, the opening weekend audience for Cinderella was 66% female. So women are turning out for movies that are proving successful, and none of them are exactly well-reviewed, certainly not 50 Shades of Grey, but they're certainly probably a little bit better quality-wise than the guy films that you pointed out to. But nonetheless, none of them are like, oh, what a great movie, and yet they're bringing out the audience. And so Hollywood is saying, is this just because those happen to be the decent movies right now, or is this a long-term trend?
Right. I think Dan Feldman put it best. He said...
Who's Dan Feldman?
He is the president of domestic distribution at Warner Brothers. I think he might even be maybe he's not the president of...
No, you're right. He's the president of domestic distribution.
I think, okay, well, you can never put your finger on it entirely, but you have to ask the questions, he said. Is this just the cyclical nature of the movie business, or does it point to a major or a more serious shift in habits?
Well, have women not always been a majority of ticket buyers at the box office? I know women buy a majority of books.
Right. No, they haven't. And as a matter of fact, that's why they've always kind of targeted young males and all these action films, these big comic book movies, 30 comic book movies they have on slate right now, all these studios.
Period, so, or in 2015?
I think in 2015, there's 30, it says here, New York Times is reporting that the studios will have nearly 30 superhero movies on the way by the end of 2015. So kind of in production or development or slated.
And you know, that sounds like too much, but there was an era when like every other movie was a Western.
Right.
8 out of top 10 shows on television were Westerns. I mean, genres come to dominate sometimes. You know, I'm sure in Japan, there are periods when samurai films were all you saw. So yeah, it gets to be overkill, but it's not necessarily like, oh, what, they're crazy. Sometimes genres can dominate for years, if not a decade or more. But I think women are obviously a natural contingent for Hollywood. They should never be making movies just for teenage boys. That's a bad business plan. Should they always be making movies for everyone?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's part of what the New York Times in their story was trying to say, is that maybe trying to do these four quadrant movies where you get, you know, people in their, you know, the gray hairs to the kids and the women and the men, that maybe you should, rather than kind of going wide and shallow, go narrow and deep.
Okay.
Wait, that make, yeah, narrow and deep. Yes, I got that right. Correct? Yes.
Yeah, but none of these movies sound like four quadrant films. Is Cinderella a four quadrant film? Is 50 Shades of Grey? Is Hot Tub Time Machine? Is Jupiter Ascending? These all sound like movies geared towards
a specific, you know, demo. Well, that's what they're trying to say, is that maybe if you actually just aim things at a very specific demographic, the demographic has the chance of opening up, kind of like Empire, where it was aimed at African Americans and yet it opened up to include a wider demographic, or more demographics than their core and target demographic. Something I think we should dub, Michael, you and I, the Empire Effect.
Okay. I don't think Empire was geared towards African Americans. It's on a major network, and I think it was geared for any audience. Hip-hop is the number one musical genre in the country, and I don't think just because the majority, if not almost all, of the actors on the show mean Empire was geared towards Black people. I think they obviously expected and hoped that that audience, which is underserved, would turn out for the show, and they certainly have. They're a big chunk of the audience, but it's clearly a big, broad hit. Dallas is not just for white people, and I don't think Empire is just for Black people. And any network that's one of the big four that says, let's make a show just for Black people, that's a dumb idea. Just like it's dumb to say, let's make a show just for white people. You know, it's got mostly Black stars, but it's for everybody.
Okay.
I think it's a big, broad entertainment designed to be a big, broad, big, fat hit, and that's why it works. If it was sort of dumbly, you know, narrow casted to just Black people, I don't think it would work. Then you got the UPN.
That's true. Although yeah, you don't have the UPN anymore. Now it's the CW.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But when a majority of white kids in the suburbs listen to hip hop and are listening to, you know, Public Enemy and NWA, or today listening to Drake and listening to Kendrick Lamar's new album, or streaming it, I suppose, it's foolish to think, oh, they're not going to watch a TV show just because it stars Black people.
In fact, they are streaming Kendrick Lamar's album on the first day. They had more streams on Spotify of Kendrick Lamar than any other album in their history. So the first day, Kendrick Lamar, I think it was like 110. I can't remember what the number was, but
it was a lot.
Yeah, Spotify was off the charts.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. Let's finish up the box office. At number three around the world is sort of an early surprise. It's Home. Good news for DreamWorks Animation. This is their new animated film. I think it's their only one for 2015, isn't it?
I think so. I think,
yeah,
yes.
It opened overseas in 9 markets. It grossed $19 million. It's doing very well in those markets. And I have to say, the movie looked a little soft to me based on the artwork and the poster. And I kind of thought, uh-oh. But it's getting a good launch overseas, and that may help the buzz here in North America.
Well, the trailer for this really sold it. It sold it at CinemaCon, and since then it sold it even more. The trailer works. And so kids really like, you know, they see the trailer and they want to go see the movie.
That's success. I want to see the Pixar movie, Inside the Brain. What's it called?
Oh, yeah, Inside Out?
Yeah, they had another trailer. I'm like, this looks so good. Sorry, DreamWorks Animation. Not trying to steal your thunder. You had a good opening weekend overseas. It's opening up in North America this week. We'll have to see how it does.
I can tell you that when they showed a little clip from Inside Out at CinemaCon last year, and CinemaCon is going to be in April this year, so it was almost a year ago this week that they showed the first footage of that film, Inside Out, from Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
And it was maybe it was probably like 3 to 4 minutes. And people went nuts. It was so good that they thought, if they can make it half as good as that 4 minutes, this is going to be a monster hit. And ever since then, everybody that's seen that clip or a little bit more says the same thing.
Yeah. Hopefully it'll be, the animated film to break through and get nominated for Best Picture again.
Ooh, that would be nice.
At number four, I'm talking about a movie I haven't seen yet, of course. At number four is Taken 3, starring Liam Neeson, another $18 million. It blasts past the $300 million mark. Cousins, nephews, second cousins twice removed of Liam Neeson, run for your life. At number five around the world is Lost and Love, a Chinese drama. This stars Tony Lau. Is it Tony Lau?
I believe
so. Or Andrew Lau. It is Andy Lau. I beg your pardon. I apologize to the Lau family. It's a Chinese drama starring Andy Lau about a dad searching for his abducted son. It's apparently based on a true story. But what I find interesting is it was written and directed by novelist and TV screenwriter Peng San-yuan in her feature film debut. So another female director breaking through in China. So that's interesting to see.
Now, I don't know whether you said that name correctly.
I am sure I didn't. And but I apologize that family.
It sure as heck sounded like you did.
At number six is Kingsman, The Secret Service. And I am puzzled by this film. Another $13 million. It's about to pass the $300 million mark. Why hasn't Fox announced a sequel?
I don't know. That's a good question.
At number seven is, it's a movie designed for sequels. At number seven is Focus. Another $11 million for that movie. This is the Will Smith film. We have boldly said, you know what? This really needs to make like $200 million, I think, in order to qualify as a hit based on the idea that Will Smith is probably getting a big chunk of the back end. But it's past $120 million and it's in 65 territories and we'll have to see where it ends up. Liam Neeson is getting a little tired, of course. Run All Night, another action drama starring Mr. Neeson. $10 million it made over the weekend, despite, frankly, a little bit better reviews than most of his recent films. It's made $35 million worldwide. And someone else trying to copy Liam Neeson is Sean Penn, who to me seems like a guy of peace. But he's starring in a new film called The Gunman, which is very much like the Liam Neeson genre that we have right now, middle-aged men kicking ass. And it only grossed $6 million over the weekend in nine territories. So not a good start for that.
I read a headline somewhere that said the Liam Neesonization of Sean Penn.
Yeah, that's about right. So Chappie is not doing well. Big Hero 6 is doing quite well. It's just about the end of its run, and it's going to hit $650 million worldwide. Second best exotic Marigold Hotel. It's not keeping quite pace with the original, which had really great legs. We'll have to see where it ends up. It's at $60 million worldwide. It's certainly going to be profitable for everyone involved. American Sniper, of course, is a massive hit, over $500 million worldwide. 50 Shades of Grey has had $550 million worldwide. Thank you, women everywhere.
And that's at number 14, just to kind of put us where we are on the chart here.
That's right. They can always look at the full chart for the issue. And then in North America, we had a movie that opened a little soft, I think, for evangelical Christians. It's called Do You Believe? It opened in 1,300 screens. It's the latest in a string of movies. Talk about narrow and deep, trying to service a very narrow audience. I mean, narrow. There's a lot of evangelical Christians in the country. But as far as movie going, people who want to see evangelical Christian films, that's a pretty narrow target audience. It opened to just $4 million. The last film by the people who were buying this movie opened on fewer screens and made more money. They're going to be a discriminating audience. When you've never seen yourself on screen, you turn out. That's why four-walling these movies, people will show up in towns. But eventually, once they start to get some more regular releases, then they start to get a little more discerning. So narrow casting works, but you got to deliver on the film.
Ooh, narrow casting. I like that.
Well, narrow casting. Made that up, but there you go.
No, not at all. But yeah, I think, you know, if this movie had made, you know, a good $8 to $9 million, which is more than double what it made during its opening weekend, it would have been considered a hit. But I agree with you. It's like 3D. Everybody shows up for the first couple movies, but then after a while, it's like, we don't need to go see Clash of the Titans.
Well, I wouldn't compare it to 3D. I would just say, you know, Asian audience, black audience, gay people, evangelical Christians, when they don't see themselves on the screen, whether it's movies or television, the first or second time you make a movie for them, yeah, they'll turn out, they don't care what the heck it is. They're like, oh my God, there we are on screen. But after that, you've got to make quality.
Well, Michael, as we say every week, you make a movie about podcasters, we're there.
That's right. And China is there, aren't they? They're probably funding a movie about podcasters right now. Well, everything that China does seems to be making news. Hollywood is just crazy about them. They make a deal with this company. They're talking with that company. Every single move of a Chinese company is getting big coverage in Hollywood.
Well, yeah, and the Huawei brothers have been talking about trying to do a co-finance deal or some kind of finance deal with U.S. company for some time. The Huawei brothers are a big group out of China, big media company out of China, and it looks like they're going to be doing it with Bob Simons, STX. Yes. 18-picture deal.
And the initial headline was, secret deal. Like, they don't even know what company they're making a deal with, but they know it involves 18 films that they're going to sort of be backing. And they just started to report it as soon as they knew a deal was happening, even though they didn't have the facts.
Yeah.
They're just so excited. They're like, China money, bring it on.
Well, yeah, I think this was rumored for months and months and months. I mean, even back at Sundance, people were talking about how STX was going to sign a deal with a Chinese company, and everybody believed it was the Huawei brothers, and sure enough, it is.
All right, there you go. So you talked about music in the introduction to the show. What's that all about?
Well, as you said, Michael, it looks like Universal Music is going to be the final label, the final record label, to settle all these lawsuits over this battle, which has been going on since, I think, 2010, since the Supreme Court decision in 2010, which was in favor of Eminem, if you recall.
That's right. And we're talking about major record labels, of course. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of labels, but the big lawsuits and the big fight is over the big labels.
That's right. And the fight is between whether, when you buy something on iTunes, you being, you know, a consumer, whether you are purchasing it and it's an outright sale, or whether you're just licensing it. And the way the record companies put it, you know, they have for years, they've kind of tried to have it both ways. They insist that fans haven't really bought any music at all. They've just kind of licensed it. And on the other hand, when it comes to artists, the labels wanted to claim that it was a sale because licenses typically apply to one-off deals like a TV show licensing and a song to use in an episode. Most artists got a much bigger piece of the pie of licenses for the simple fact that they were a much smaller part of the business. So on sales, artists only got, say, like 15%, while on licenses, they would ordinarily get 50%. So
talk about speaking out of both sides of your mouth.
Yeah.
They tell audience fans, oh, yeah, you don't own that album. You just licensed it. But then they turn around to the artist and say, oh, no, we haven't licensed that song. We've sold it because look at your contract. We can't give you all that money.
Yeah. And an artist said, well, wait a second. If you're telling consumers that they're only licensing it, then it's a license. So out of every dollar, you owe us 50 cents, not 15 cents.
Right. Now, this I find fascinating because the labels have basically come to an agreement. I don't know if they've renegotiated the royalty rate, saying, well, we won't give you 50, but what about 40%? Or I don't know what's been going on. But they've been paying out big bucks because the artists have been winning in court. I mean, the labels clearly said these are licenses, and therefore they can't turn around to their artists and say, oh, it's a sale.
Well, Eminem took this all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, this is kind of not open and shut, but hey, it's a license.
I know, and when I heard Ruth Bader Ginsburg rap, I just was so happy. I never thought I'd see that in the Supreme Court, but the way she dropped the mic at the end, that was awesome.
Okay, maybe I wish I had been there that day.
I wish they'd been live streaming it on Meerkat.
Oh, what a good callback. That's amazing.
So this is fascinating to me. We've got the labels and the artists coming together and agreeing, okay, this is a license. We're going to pay out all this money. Here's what we're going to do going forward. And what that means to me is that in the future, when you and I, Sperling, regular Joes, we've bought all these movies and TV shows and music in digital format. And as far as I'm concerned, we bought them. And it's going to have to be a case that also goes all the way to the Supreme Court to determine, yeah, you know what? When people bought that album, they actually did buy that album. And that's going to be a big fight. And I think consumers will win. But when that fight happens, now you're going to find that your lovable artists like U2 and Eminem and all them are going to be arrayed against you alongside with the major record labels because it's now in their financial interest to insist, no, no, you don't own that album. You're just borrowing it.
Yeah, it will be. I know this is going to be a case that goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And at one point, Bruce Willis was kind of, remember
that's right,
we talked about that he was really upset that he couldn't leave his iTunes music collection to his.
Not that he's dead, but yeah, he was talking people were saying, hey, look, I've spent $5,000, $10,000 on all this digital content. And when I die, it just disappears. You're like, no, I want to leave it to my kids. So now, you know, iTunes and others have sort of accommodated that and done things. But yeah, this sort of thing is going on. But the funny thing is, this case will go all the way to the Supreme Court and it will get decided just when actual sales end forever.
Yeah, I was going to say.
People aren't buying stuff anymore. They just stream it. It'll be a classic case where they settle something finally once it doesn't matter.
Yes, that's like, I completely agree. That it's like that Apple case recently where they said, yes, the iPod did infringe on that particular patent. Unfortunately, nobody buys iPods anymore.
That's right. So that brings us to the music from the news from the Record Industry Association of America, doesn't it?
The RIAA, as it's called. It's the Recording Academy. They're the ones that hand out those little shiny things every year.
And what did they say?
By the way, the shiny things are Grammys, FYI.
The RIAA does that?
Yes, I believe so. Yes.
Is it Okay, it's not Naris or somebody else. I don't know who does the Grammys.
I thought it was the RIAA, but I don't know. I know one thing they do. They put together facts and figures, and this year they said that, you know, 2014, the music industry's value is $6.97 billion, which is kind of down a little bit from 2013.
A little bit?
Well, 0.47% decline.
Oh, but I mean, oh, from like the heyday of the of the 90s.
It was like $20 billion. So yeah, it's down a lot from that.
Yeah,
from,
let's always keep it in a long-term context. When you talk about bookstores, people say, bookstores are back. They've risen the last five. Yeah, but they're like a third or a fourth of what they used to be in the 90s. So don't pretend bookstores have come back.
So it's kind of like vinyl sales last year when they said, they're the biggest, you know, the biggest increase. Yeah, well, from nothing to a few is
hundreds of millions of dollars now for vinyl.
I know.
Vinyl, well, it grew 50% last year.
Well, let's talk about some of these numbers. You have digital music grew by $140 million to $4.5 billion. So that's up 3.2%.
So they mean by digital music, they mean sales of digital singles and albums?
Correct. So that's sales and streaming. Okay. So it's not just.
Oh, so they're counting subscriptions.
Yes.
Oh, okay. So what's that total?
So that total of sales and subscriptions and all digital music, $4.5 billion. Now remember, $7 billion roughly is the total number.
Okay. So the majority of sales are coming digitally.
That's right. Physical
music
sales.
Whether people are streaming or whatever, the money that people are pulling in is coming from digital.
That is correct.
And in fact, even CDs is being overshadowed by digital, isn't it?
Well, forget about overshadowed by digital. It's being overshadowed by digital streaming. You had CD sales falling 12.3% to $1.85 billion, whereas streaming made $1.87 billion last year.
So even streaming alone is beating CD sales. And you know why that is? Because you can't buy CDs anymore.
Yes.
There are no stores selling CDs. You walk around Manhattan, it's very hard to find a compact disc.
Well, so you've got CD sales falling 12.3%. You got streaming revenue going up 29% last year. Vinyl sales, as you say, is now up 50% to $320.8 million.
And so when you talk about, hey, look, it's streaming, it's doing great. Digital sales, it's more than CDs. Streaming is doing, but you know what? There's a lot more people in between the artist and that money.
Well, and not only that, but you think that, you know, the licensing fee versus the broadcast royalty, the transmission royalty, much less. So you're taking, forget about digital dimes. You're now getting like streaming pennies.
Streaming micro pennies, tenths of a penny. Yeah, and of course, we're talking about, look, you've lost like $10 billion in actual sales from like a decade ago.
And mind you, this is only in the U.S., we should point out, only in the U.S.
So, but the trends are happening all over the world.
Yes, correct.
It is pretty indicative of what's going on. Some countries are ahead, some countries are behind us, but this is where the whole industry worldwide is going. But when you're looking at like all the loss, you've lost $10 billion in sales. Okay, now you're getting back like $1.8 billion in streaming subscription. Yeah, but you've got Spotify taking money and then the label taking money and then it gets to the artist.
Right, that's right. And it's much less to begin with.
So what are they all fighting about? I know there's a big dispute over Spotify. Of course there is.
Are you talking about this dispute with, I guess it's 19 Recordings, right? The label.
The American Idol label.
Yeah.
That's the home, former home of Kelly Clarkson and Carrie Underwood. They are suing Sony. Because just like we had a minute ago with Universal and the artists, where they were arguing over how to classify these sales, same thing is happening with Spotify. Same thing with streaming services. Sony was counting the money that came from Spotify as sales and distribution rather than broadcasts or transmission. These are all technical terms. Why are they counted as sales and distribution rather than broadcasts or transmission? Well, we haven't seen the contracts, but we're going to go out on a limb and say that the artists probably get a bigger cut when you classify it one way versus the other. So the labels are saying, no, that's actually a sale again. So if you buy a CD, it's a sale. If you buy it digitally, it's a license, unless you're talking to the artist, in which case it's a sale. And if you're streaming the album, that's a sale again, even though you don't actually own it.
Well, and it's kind of tricky because, you know, if it's Pandora, that's a broadcast license and they're paying, you know, royalties based on that. So,
right.
And SiriusXM as well, because it's, you know, radio broadcast, you pay a certain fee. Well, technically, Spotify should be able to pay the same thing. However, Spotify went and cut deals with the labels. So is it a sale, even though they could technically be paying the blanket license, but they're not because they cut a special deal. So is it a license or a sale? I get where the record labels are trying to come from, but
no, they're trying to come from whatever gets them the most money.
Yeah. Now, if
you
notice,
that's the only place they're coming from. They don't care what they call it if it means they get more money. Of course they do.
And the record labels saw this coming, you know, I'd say a good 10 years ago, because if you notice, it's not, you know, Mumford and Sons fighting over this. It's artists that, you know, like Eminem, who cut deals in the 90s or the early 2000s, who have these long-term record contracts where they actually did get 50% of the licensing fees. Of course, the record companies realize, well, that's we've got to change that. And so later artists from, like, you know, the late 2000s and, you know, the early teens here, they have completely different contracts, and so it doesn't matter to them.
However, once you break out, then you can renegotiate.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, I mean, every new act gets a piss poor contract, but then you know where the money is and what to fight for. But the Recording Industry Association of America, they released all this new end of the year data, and they had things to say about it, what I would call fighting words. And it's no surprise, because they realize there are tectonic changes in the industry. Streaming is here to stay, they say, and payments must rise. They think more money has to come to the labels and the artists. And the battle cry of the RIAA, this is what they say, is fair market value for all creators, regardless of platform.
Right. Okay, so they're basically saying, you know how it's like radio, and if it's on-demand radio, it gets one thing. If it's just broadcast radio, it gets another fee. They say, forget all that. Let's just get a flat fee.
That's not what they're arguing for.
Well, no. I know, but they're trying to simplify it.
They're not asking for a simple flat fee. They're just saying, you've got to pay up. You're using music to make bit money. We don't care if you're streaming. We understand it's a different business and there's different, you know, metrics to measure, but you got to pay. You can't just say, oh, well, we're streaming, so you get 1/10 of a penny. That's the fact that you're streaming doesn't matter to us. If you're making money, we should be making money and we want our cut. It's not that there'd be a flat rate for every single version. It's just you got to pay up, and streaming is not paying up. And okay, fair market value for all creators, regardless of platform. It's not exactly give me liberty or give me death, but it is. They're backing it up. They also say,
is it Viva La France?
By the way, the NARIS is the one that does the Grammys, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, not the RIAA. But here's another thing that they said.
So please don't write in. I've already been corrected.
Here's another thing that they said. This is a big, I don't know how long they've been arguing this. They've probably been saying it for a while, but they're saying it again.
Since 1973? Oh, you're doing the terrestrial.
No. Terrestrial radio has got to start paying artists and labels. Right now, they don't pay them. They only pay publishers, meaning they get a blanket license from BMI or ASCAP. And the people who write the song get money when it's played on the radio. But the people who recorded the song and the label who released the song don't get any money. Why is that?
Because it's advertising.
In the old days, they thought, hey, you play it on the radio, I'm going to make a sale. Great. Everybody was happy. It's a whole new world. And now they want more money. And they say, quote, it's time for this special interest exemption to end. This special interest exemption, by the way, is the way the industry has operated for 100 years.
That's right.
They make it sound like this weird little quirk. And they say it is inexcusable that streaming services don't have to pay anyone for using music recorded before 1972. What are they talking about?
Well, isn't that the Copyright Act?
That's right. It's something like that was in, you know, they did a new act to oversee payments, and that went into effect in 1972.
No, I think it went into effect in 1976.
Well, it
wasn't
made retroactive beyond 1972.
That's right, yeah.
So the fact was that if your music was recorded before 1972 and released, that people could just play it on the air.
Was that because the Beatles broke up in like 1969, 1970?
It might be. It might be just like copyright keeps getting extended because of Mickey Mouse. Maybe the big companies in the other way were able to say, hey, let's cut it off at 1972 because God knows we don't want to have to pay the Beatles anymore.
Yeah, well, and I think Neil Young has a little something to say about that. He's not too pleased.
That's right. So with all these changes, you know, Taylor Swift was out there talking about Spotify, thinking, does this make any sense anymore? And the RIAA is saying, we want more money for our labels and our artists. What's happening with streaming services and specifically Spotify? The major labels really are going, you know, just because we've been doing it this way doesn't mean we have to keep doing this way forever. Maybe we should be rethinking this.
Right, and maybe asking for more money, which would, of course, mean that Spotify wouldn't cost $9 a month or $10 a month for all of us. It might cost $12 or $14 or $15, or more people would actually have to subscribe to said services to actually even out the losses of sales.
Well, it's not that they necessarily want people to have to pay more per month, but they just want more people to pay, which means making the free service less fun. You know, they say, hey, you could make premium a lot better with higher sound quality and more exclusives. You can also make free worse with more ads and a lot less content. Why is a new album available for free the day it comes out? Maybe giving away every album in your library for free isn't such a great idea. You know, maybe a new album comes out and it's available on the premium service, and then 6 months or a year later, then it becomes free. You know, just like a window like you have with movies, you know.
And that's working so well, by the way, Michael. Incredibly well.
Is it not?
No, I'm saying that, you know, everybody's fighting about it all the time.
Right, but adjusting it. But there's no window right now. Now it's just if a new album, when the Kendrick Lamar album comes out, you can play it right away.
Yes.
And they're saying, maybe that doesn't make any sense. It's brand new. It's exciting. We want people to pay for premium. Maybe that album should not be on the free service. Spotify says, well, duh, we're supposed to be fighting piracy. And if it's not available for free on this service where they have to hear ads and do stuff, we try to convince them to pay for premium. If it's not available here, they're just going to go steal it.
Yeah. Well, and maybe there should be more ads for those types of albums.
To make it even less, you know, make you really want to say, you know what, I'm listening to this all the time. It's worth it for me to pay for free.
Right. Whereas like, you know, something from 1970, since, you know, they're not paying for it anyway. Hey, you know what? Listen to 10 in a row without an ad.
So YouTube, I mean, ad sales are up 50% every year for the past 3 years on YouTube. Ad sales are growing there. That's a place where a lot of people play music. Spotify has music available for free and they have some ads. Labels are saying maybe there should be more. Maybe every album shouldn't be available right away. We got to do something to make sure more people are paying for this service. And Spotify is fighting them every step of the way because they think it's a horrible idea. Why? Because they're making a lot of money.
Well, remember, they only make, I think it was, what was it, 25-30% of whatever their revenue is. That's their deals.
What's wrong with that?
That's their deals with
25-30% of $1.8 billion? That seems like a good job.
Well, again, it's not just them earning that $1.8 billion, but yes.
Well, they get 30% of that?
No, it's not just, what I'm saying is there are other streaming services beyond Spotify.
That's true. Spotify is doing okay.
Yeah, I'm not crying for them. Not right yet. Not right now. I'm not crying for Madonna either, by the way.
Oh, why not? She has the number two album in the country. What is the best-selling album in the country? That's what I want to know.
Well, it depends on who you ask, because Billboard says it's the soundtrack to the smash TV hit Empire, but Billboard also says it's the new Madonna album, Rebel Heart.
And what?
Here's the deal. Billboard always has and always will fiddle with like the methodology behind their charts. And for example, you know, how do they account for millions of plays of a video? You were just mentioning YouTube. How do they account for that when deciding the number one song in the country? And it all goes into some formula that balances sales of singles and traditional radio play. And now things like streaming and plays on YouTube and Spotify and other services. That's how they figure out the number one song in the country. The same thing is happening for album sales. So, you know, they did it for songs, now they're doing it for albums, which you'd think should be easier. After all, there's no airplay to speak of for an album necessarily, the way there is for a single, but not really. New albums get streamed in their entirety, as you just mentioned, Michael, on services where such things are possible, like Pandora. And, well, I don't think you can stream the entire album on Pandora, but certainly you can on Spotify. So now that becomes part of Billboard's formula. And Madonna's Rebel Heart sold 116,000 copies, both digitally and in physical formats. Empire sold 110,000, which is, of course, less. But Empire was streamed a lot more. Yeah, thanks to those early leaks, Madonna pointed out. So when all was said and done, Billboard credited Empire with 130,000 copies sales, which includes what are called track equivalent album sales and stream equivalent album sales. If people spend money or listen to ads and then take the time to stream your entire new album, I guess the thinking is it all evens out somehow.
Right, you deserve some sort of credit for that.
Right.
You know, those are the new rules. And it makes sense. I mean, in my mind, I'm sort of like, well, gosh, you know, music, the number one song was always a combination of airplay and sales. So people could buy the single, it could get played on the radio, and sometimes it would be selling more than it would be played, and it would be played more than it would be sold. So you had to come up with some sort of formula to put that together and figure out what was the most popular song in the country. Album was a totally different beast. It was just sales. You know, sometimes, yes, album-oriented rock stations would play the entire side or an entire album you know, from beginning to end and say, oh, tune in at 10 p.m. to hear part two of Dark Side of the Moon. You know, they would do that. But still, basically, album sales were just sales. The number one album in the country was the album that sold the most. And I hate the fact that they're sort of changing that. But if streaming is the way we go, you know, in 5 or 10 years, the album sales would be so out of whack from what was the most popular album in the country that week that it would look stupid and become irrelevant. So they have to change it.
And you know what? In a way, yes, and in a way, no. I mean, I think, yes, there needs to be some change.
It can't be in a way, yes, and in a way, no. Well, it's either yes or no.
What I'm saying is there needs
Hello, Switzerland.
How you doing?
Frankie Pants.
Guten Tag. So I think a change needs to be made, but at the same time, is this the change that needs to be made? And what I mean by that is I sometimes listen to albums on Spotify that I would never purchase, ever. And the reason I do that is because I can. So just because I've listened to the album doesn't mean I'd ever buy it. And I'd ever listen to it again.
Well, but one stream is not going to count as much as one sale. You know, that's why they fiddle with the formula. You know, it was streamed like
Fair
whatever.
Enough. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to work on the formula. But it's true, you took the time to listen to the album. And maybe if the song plays on the radio, if you change the channel, well, that's going to affect the radio station. Eventually, they'll learn not to play that song. So you paying attention and listening counts.
I
think it's a big deal.
Oh, well, let me ask you this. If you think that's a big deal, I have a few other stories for you. Because it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Bring it on.
Our first story, one of the longest running collaborations in film history is taking a time out. Not because, you know, it was a bad child, but, you know. We're talking about director Steven Spielberg and composer John Williams, who have worked together on almost every film in Spielberg's 30-plus years of directing. In fact, Williams has composed music for every single Spielberg film since 1985 when Quincy Jones did the score for The Color Purple. This time, it's not that the project calls for a special touch. In fact, it's the Cold War drama Bridge of Spies starring Tom Hanks, which Williams could score in his sleep and still get an Oscar nomination. Apparently, Williams had a brief health issue, and that messed up his schedule. All is well, and he'll be back behind the podium for Spielberg's next film, the family-friendly BFG. I don't know what that stands for. Big Friendly Giant? I don't know what BFG stands for.
Yes.
It is? I just guessed that.
It's a Roald Dahl novel.
Oh, I knew that. I should have known that, right?
Sure.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, this kind of timeout, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, of course. It's just a little tweak in a career that's been so remarkable how much. I don't think there's ever been anything like it. I mean, you think of Hitchcock and, of course, what composer?
Bernard Herrmann.
That's right. I can't think of any other director with that sort of link to a composer the way Spielberg has with John Williams. And, you know, I'm just ashamed he won't do this movie, but I'm sure they'll be right back in the swim of things soon. So thank God they didn't have a fight.
What about Henry Mancini? Did he have somebody that he worked with on a regular basis?
Not particularly, not that I know of.
Okay, well.
I mean, yeah, but no, the BFG is The Big Friendly Giant, and it's a children's book by Roald Dahl. I don't even know how to say his name. And it's going to star the great stage actor Mark Rylance, who is going to be in a few weeks on PBS in Wolf Hall, the adaptation of the big Hilary Mantel novel. So Mark Rylance has been a huge theater force for many years. He has been in a few movies like Angels and Insects, which you could check out from many years ago. But he's really become a big movie star pretty soon. He's going to have an Emmy for Wolf Hall. He's going to be in a big film with Steven Spielberg. He's like my favorite theater actor. And suddenly now he's doing all this other media. It's very exciting.
Kind of like Bobby Cannavale.
That's right. He broke out as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, since we're talking about theater, the spring theater season is heating up as a dozen or so big ticket shows vie to win Tony Awards for Best Musical, Best Musical Revival, Best Play, and so on. Gigi, An American in Paris, The Goofy, Something Rotten, The King and I, and many more are kind of crowding the boards along the Great White Way. And yet, the biggest news is still about Hamilton, the new musical by Lin-Manuel Miranda playing at the Public. That show decided not to rush to Broadway in hopes of winning the Tony. They'll open in late summer as the first show of the next season, risking the possibility that Hamilton will seem like old news come Tony time in 2016. But ticket sales tell a different story. Hamilton has sold more than $10 million in tickets and group sale commitments, making it far more successful than most of the shows, if not all of the new shows opening right now. In other Broadway news, Sony is going to turn the Carole King musical Beautiful into a feature film, and Russell Simmons is hoping to return to Broadway. He was there already with Def Poetry Jam, but this time with an original musical about the early days of rap and hip-hop. Big deal or big whoop?
It'll be a big deal if I am cast as Wonder Mike, because that's what I'm hoping for when it comes to the Russell Simmons show. And Carole King, I just hope they don't let Clint Eastwood direct it.
Oh, is that a Jersey Boys reference?
That is a Jersey Boy. What else could it possibly be? But yeah, no, Hamilton is looking like it's going to be a, you know, there's a huge anticipation for it on Broadway. People are very eager to see it. It's only a few months of delay, so it's not like they waited a year or something. So that looks like it's shaping into the really hot show ticket of the fall.
Well,
but they may have been smart to not come in the spring because the buzz on Something Rotten is getting louder and louder. This is a musical about the creation of the first musical. Competitors of Shakespeare come up with the musical to compete with the Bard. And it's apparently just a hoot and a half. All the boards are just people are raving about it. So maybe Hamilton wasn't the lock that it seemed to be. You know, not that it wouldn't already, you know, still have been the favorite. But, you know, it wasn't going to be the only game in town if the buzz about Something Rotten paves out.
Well, and as you know, Michael, Hamilton is getting such hot buzz even here in Los Angeles that I was planning a trip to New York in the summer to see Hamilton.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I called to see if you could get me tickets.
Oh, right. And I said, no way. Buy them now.
Yeah. And you also said, hey, you know what? It's only opening in August. It's going to be in previews in July. You may want to wait. Wait until, like, you know, September, October after it actually opens.
No, what I said was wait till as close to the opening as possible because they are going to be tweaking it. So you don't want to see it early in previews on Broadway because they're going to be working on it a lot. So, you know, the closer you can get to the opening night, as always, is better. I tend not to see a show until like right before it opens or as soon after as possible.
And I think I'm going to do the latter.
Terrific. Well, have you bought your tickets yet?
Have I called you to buy my tickets yet?
Well, me, you need house seats. Oh, okay. So, okay. Because you can buy just tickets right now online, you know.
Oh, I know.
Okay.
All right. In fact, it's $10 million in 11 days. That's not bad.
Yeah.
One thing you can be certain about the smash hit Empire, whenever season 2 begins and Fox desperately hopes that can be this fall, the show is certain to rise in the ratings. It's never done anything else, so why should season 2 be any different? Yes, the hip-hop spin-on primetime soaps like Dallas grew in its season finale, hitting 16.5 million viewers in the overnights, 21 million in Live Plus 3, and who knows how many more once Live Plus 7 ratings are out. Hulu knows a good thing when they see it. They've snagged the streaming video on demand rights to the show. We're not big fans of demos. Eyeballs are eyeballs, as far as Showbiz Sandbox is concerned, but
or
Empire,
ears are ears.
Yes. Empire did score the biggest season 1 finale in key demos since it's been the biggest since Grey's Anatomy back in 2005. For those of you keeping score at home, that is 10 years ago. And that show, by the way, still on the air. Big deal or big whoop?
Clearly a big deal. This is a phenomenon. There's no other way to put it.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, Nashville, you know that primetime show on ABC?
Oh, I do.
They're having yet another tour, but somehow it's country music and it's not that big a hit, so it feels just fine. But Empire going on tour, not a good idea.
I agree. They're going to milk that and they did the same thing with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. They put it on, they stripped it, put it on five days a week, and then everybody got tired of it in under a year.
That was a nightmare.
But, yeah, no, I mean, on my RSS reader, which I know, Michael, you don't have an RSS reader, but the stories about Empire, whether it was on Vulture or Variety or the New York Times, LA Times, they were all writing stories about the finale of Empire. What to expect were the stories before it aired. And then afterward, you know, what happened on the finale. And then the day after, they were all stories about the phenomenon of Empire and why it's a phenomenon. And literally the sharing on these stories, like 44,000 shares. And this is just one RSS reader. There's, you know, dozens of RSS readers. I was shocked at how much people were sharing these stories.
That's when you got a hit.
Now, usually it's memoirs that create a lot of headaches for publishers. You know, Holocaust survivors who weren't actually ever in a death camp. Guys who toughed it out in prison that actually never went to prison, and so on. But now, even cookbooks are giving publishers headaches. Australia has suffered two embarrassments recently. First, one publisher decided not to go forward with a cookbook touting the paleo diet for babies after experts had a look at the recipes. Newborn babies, of course, need a very different diet than adults who are trying to lose weight. And one expert said, in my view, there's a very real possibility that a baby may die if this book goes ahead.
Talk about a blurb.
Yeah. Can I put that on the cover or the back cover? Yeah. The jacket flap? Nonetheless, celebrity chef Pete Evans says he'll do an ebook on his own in April.
That's astonishing to me. He's like, oh, yeah.
Hey, I've got ringing endorsements.
Yeah.
Another top publisher has to yank the new cookbook, The Whole Pantry by Belle Gibson, off the shelves and not the pantry shelves. First, the Sydney Morning Herald reported that Gibson had solicited donations for five charities from her hundreds of thousands of followers on the social medias, but none of the charities say they ever received money from her. Oops. That's when the publisher decided, you know, they're going to actually look into Gibson's claims for her cookbook. She insisted that she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, but healthy living, natural therapies, and her delicious recipes kept her alive. That and the fact that she never had cancer were you know, perfect.
Oh, I don't know what she had, but they weren't. They couldn't back up what she said.
Yeah, they couldn't actually. The publishing house couldn't prove any of her claims to their satisfaction. So they pulled the book. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. These things happen. The labels took the right step. I mean, a paleo diet for babies. Talk about a ridiculous extension of a fad. But, you know, it's like the Atkins diet for newborns. Like, that doesn't sound like a good idea. And I am not touting myself at all. I'm pointing out how did they get this far? Because actually, before the story came out, I'm on my my website, Book Filter, and I'm constantly picking what books to do. And when it comes to health, and cookbooks, I'm always like, if they say holistic, I ignore it. If they got a blur from Deepak Chopra, I'm like, okay, I don't like you. You know, so I saw
what do you have against Deepak Chopra?
Because he's a joke. You know, Dr. Oz, they're jokes. So this book comes out and it's The Whole Pantry. And I'm reading this. This is the description. Diagnosed with terminal brain cancer at the age of 20, Belle Gibson found herself without support and out of sync with conventional medicine. So began a journey of self-education that resulted in her getting back to basics as she healed herself through nutrition and lifestyle changes. To which I immediately said, give me a break, and said, forget that. I'm not putting this book as a top pick. I mean, that's not any credit to me. She had terminal brain cancer, but she healed herself through nutrition and lifestyle changes.
She was out of sync with traditional medicine?
Yeah, yeah. You know, the boring chemotherapy and all that stuff.
With reality.
Yeah, how did that get so far? But anyway.
Somebody was asleep at the switch, or the printing press, whichever came first. Now, actor and entrepreneur Joseph Gordon-Levitt is speeding up his film career again after what seemed like a little bit of a lull while he focused on his creative website, Hit Record. Now JGL, as Michael likes to call him, has that biopic about Edward Snowden in the works. I don't think it's a biopic. I think Mr. Gordon-Levitt is just leaking secrets. Actually, I think no matter what the film is like, it's sure to be controversial to someone. So he's pivoting to also star in the family-friendly Jim Henson creation, Fraggle Rock. Actually, the beloved HBO series is about a multi-culty group of Fraggles who subtly call for world peace and other hippy-dippy sentiments. So that's probably controversial to someone somewhere as well. Gordon-Levitt had this to say in a statement reported by Variety. He said, Jim Henson's characters make you laugh and sing, but they're also layered, surprising, and wise. From Oscar the Grouch to Yoda to the Fraggles, I've never stopped loving his work, even as a young, frisky man, and on into adulthood. Collaborating with Lisa Henson makes me confident we can do something that Jim would have loved. Frisky? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, of course. Actor gets role, as our friend Karen Woodward would say. Maybe it's wrong to say I felt like he's sort of had a lull in his acting career. I mean, he's been working steadily. He was in, you know, Dark Knight Rises and Looper, which didn't do a great deal of business, and Lincoln, and Don John was in 2013. And
yeah, he directed a movie, which usually takes a big chunk of your life away.
Which what does?
Directing a movie. When you spend 18 months.
So that came out in 2013. And then really 2014, he just had a voiceover work in The Wind Rises and Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, which didn't do well, but but that took time. But really it's been like 2013, he directed a film. And now finally at the end of 2015, he's got a clutch of movies coming out. He's got The Walk, which I'm very excited by at Christmas time. That's the Philippe Petit story, the guy who walked between the Twin Towers. And then he has something else, a Christmas Eve project. And he's got Snowden, which is filming. That's for Oliver Stone. Stone, and now the Fraggle Rock movie. So I feel like he is picking up steam again, and I think he's a terrific actor. So I think it's a big deal. Never mind what Karen says. I'm excited.
Well, you know, actually, if you look at the timing of this, you can see that where he directed his movie, okay, is probably the time frame where he wasn't starring in a lot of films, and therefore there was a lull, at least in releases, in which he appeared.
That's right.
So that's really, and now, of course, then in about the mid-2013, 2014 timeframe, he started acting again, and now you're getting all these films. So it makes sense, actually.
And it was also doing the TV show, you know, Hit Record, and the website, and he had a TV special for that, or a few episodes.
Yes.
So, you know, that took up time, too.
Yes.
That's but you're true. Right, yeah, because, you know, if you act in the film, it usually takes a couple months, 3 months maybe. And if you direct a film, you're talking a year and a half, 2 years.
Yes. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess this week, how are they affecting you? Well, I don't know. Are you cutting your cord?
Ding dong, the cord is dead. The wicked old cord, the stupid cord. Ding dong, the wicked old cord is dead.
Well, the cord might be dead, but that's the coax cable cord is dead. The Ethernet cable cord is still very much alive.
So what's happening? We're talking about cord cutting, aren't we? And everybody's doing stories saying that cord cutting has come. Cord cutting has arrived. People are now doing it. It's a real thing.
Well, much like in the music business, you have people, they're not buying CDs anymore. They're downloading them. Okay, so where the money comes from shifted. Well, now they're not downloading them anymore and buying them on iTunes. They're streaming them. Again, where the revenue comes from shifts. So I think what's happening here is you've got a lot of people who have noticed, you know what, I'm paying $80, $120 a month for this huge cable package filled with 700 channels that I watch 10 of. I just want to pay for the content I want, not the content that they want to force down my throat. So if there is cord cutting going on, and there is some evidence to show that, yes, people are kind of trimming down their media habits when it comes to cable and satellite TV, they're going backwards, though, and I'm sure they will soon find out, oh, that's what the bundle was for, because they're spending $9 on Netflix, and they're spending $8 on Hulu, and then they're spending Amazon Prime is $8.50 a month, and then you got CBS is $6 a month, HBO is $15 a month. So you have all of these different places where you can get the content you want, but when you start adding them all up, if you start going for all of them, you wind up at $50, $60, $70. Now, it might be $50, $60, $70 that you're spending for the content that you actually want instead of $120, $60 of which you actually want, and the other $60 is being wasted.
Well, I don't know if they'll be saving money eventually because there's so many different services that it all adds up pretty quick. But the fact is that people have talked about cord cutting for a long time, and cord cutting is finally here. But as far as we're concerned, it's dead. People are not cutting the cord. Traditionally, that meant, you know what? I'm paying all this money for cable. I don't care about TV. Forget it. I don't need it anymore. I can live my life without it.
I have noticed a lot of millennials backwards. So, you know, people 30 and under, I know at least 12 that
right.
don't have cable at all. They don't even have a TV antenna. They just
But they watched Empire.
No, they haven't. Some have, some haven't.
Oh, well, but I'm saying a lot of people now, they just get their TV content in other ways. So it's not that they're getting rid of television or they don't care about TV or they're not paying money. It's just they're getting it over the top, or they're watching it on Hulu, or they're doing some other service. So, you know, they're finding other ways, but it's costing them money. They're not suddenly, you know, not buying cable TV and not watching television and reading books. They're consuming TV because TV is as big a deal as ever as far as, you know, where all the hot entertainment properties are. They're watching The Walking Dead. They're watching Empire. And there's just all these new services, and they are not examples of cord cutting. They are examples of TV switching from cable and satellite to over the top. We're not switching, but perhaps this is a big new area of growth. It won't supplant them permanently, but it is where all the action is happening. So
well,
you've got,
and you might recall last May, after I had a couple conversations with people in the, whether it was SVOD with subscription video on demand or VOD or over the top world, that after Dish cut that deal with Disney where Dish could go out and sell subscriptions to the Disney channels.
And ESPN, TBS, Disney, ABC, stuff like that.
To non-subscribers. You might recall I said that what was being reported back to me was that this had opened a floodgate of over-the-top conversations. Everybody wanted to know, oh my goodness, linear television, the way we get television today, where one show is after another on a channel that follows another channel. That seemed to be kind of, it had been given a diagnosis of being terminal.
Yeah. I mean, with the DVR, forget that. I mean, it still happens, you know, placement matters. If you're, the Odd Couple is getting sampled because it follows the Big Bang Theory, you know? So, I mean, that still works. It still matters. But yeah, it's a very different way of consuming TV. I know people who don't want to watch a show until the entire season is over. That's right. Why they like Netflix. So that's why they wait until it comes out on Blu-ray, because they don't want to bother waiting week after week. They're impatient. But now you look at this. Sony, after Dish Network did that deal, and I'm not sure that actually includes ABC. It's $20 a month for 20 channels, and I think no major networks. They have ESPN, TBS, Disney, and all that stuff that's available from the Disney company. Now Sony PlayStation is offering a service. It's $50.
In three cities, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but they're going to expand it. I mean, yes. Right. It's $50 a month for 50 channels like USA, Discovery, FX, Comedy Central, and CBS, NBC, Fox, but no ABC or their affiliates like ESPN or Disney. So that's $50 a month for 50 channels. If you want more tiers, they'll cost an extra $10 to $20 a month with, you know, different sports stuff being offered. So, you know, now you're up to $70 a month just for that service. Apple has a service, but nobody knows apparently what'll be in it, but it's not going to be NBC because they haven't come to terms with them. And nobody knows what it'll cost. And then, like you say, you've got all these individual channels. Nickelodeon Noggin, which is an ad-free service for $6 a month. Netflix is $8 a month. Amazon Prime is $8.50 a month, but you also get free shipping. HBO is $15 a month and on and on. And everybody is going to offer their stuff over the top.
And it's all going to be more over the top than it is in cable packages. And here's why. They can't, HBO, CBS, all of these television networks, be they cable, broadcast, or premium, they can't go at you directly at a cheaper price than what they're offering to MSOs. And an MSO
They want to undercut the money that they're getting already.
Right. So they're basically saying, no, don't worry, cable operators. People are still going to want to buy it from you because you have the cheaper price. You get to sell it for $12 a month, whereas we're selling HBO directly for $15 a month. Where would you go? Of course, you're going to go to you because you're cheaper. Well, yeah, for a time. But then what will wind up happening is more people will switch over to, you know, buying direct, possibly.
So one analyst was quoted in the New York Times. It's Rich Greenfield with BTIG Research. He says, quote, "The reality is each individual service is not all that important. But when you start to layer lots of different options together, you have the ability to piece together your own bundle. I don't think it's about saving money as much as it is about empowering consumers to build the experience you want."
I agree with that, actually, the latter part. I definitely agree.
I definitely don't. What, people don't want to save money? They're like, no, I really want to pay the same money for fewer channels. I hate all those extra options.
Well, I think it's
because I never watched AMC until suddenly Mad Men came on it. So if I've got this bundling package 10 years ago, I was not going to ask for AMC because they didn't have Mad Men. They didn't have Breaking Bad. They didn't have The Walking Dead. And I never watched, you know, Remember When or old movies. And so I never had AMC. So guess what? When that channel's not an option, suddenly you're like, you don't have access to it. Shows don't become as big hits as they were before. People can't watch. You can't suddenly turn to FX and watch, you know, Archer or whatever it may be. Yeah, and who bought Comedy Central before The Daily Show, you know?
Well, you know what? I would say, and let's get to that for a second, because you're mentioning a whole lot of networks here that got their start because they were part of a bigger conglomerate, okay? And they were bundled into all these cable packages, and you were paying for them whether you wanted them or not. So they were able to actually build up an audience over time, sometimes years. And slowly they got programming that people were willing to watch and wanted to watch, and thus, you know, that people were more willing to pay for those channels, even though they were forced to
cable, right? You know, yeah.
And so, what I think there's a couple points here. I think, you know, going back to Apple for a second, I do think it's very funny that like NBC is not a part of it, because Apple and NBC, well, Apple and Comcast had a bit of a tiff because Apple was in negotiations with Comcast to build their set-top box. Uh-huh. And Apple eventually said, you know what, you're just stringing us along while you work on your own set-top box, and you're kind of blowing us off, so forget it. So now those two are fighting. But as you know, there's always been rumors about Apple talking to the TV networks, and the networks have always rebuffed them and said, no, we're not interested, we're not interested, we're not interested. Until recently. And why is that? Because once the networks decided, oh my gosh, okay, we're going to have to go over the top in some way, shape, or form, because existing models, they're just kind of evaporating, they still need to gain the broad reach and install base of a technology manufacturer like Apple, where if you're a part of that Apple package, you could easily be in 100 million homes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why all of a sudden, Apple, you're my best friend. Why? Because you're going to want to keep some of that licensing fee, that carriage fee that Apple will pay you on a month-to-month basis, because you're a part of that subscription package. Whereas if you're not a part of a cable subscription package, you may not even exist. And that's what I think is going to happen to some of these small cable networks, which they as I say, they've survived on these per subscriber carriage fees that they get each month. But with cord cutters,
and there are niche people that enjoy them,
right? However, there aren't enough niche people that enjoy them to actually pay for them properly. So
you know what's a great example of that? ESPN. Because when you talk to people and find out that they find out they're paying $6 a month for ESPN, they're like, I never watch ESPN. A lot of people don't watch ESPN. I watch ESPN like twice a year. I just watch the Saturday night for wrestling, collegiate wrestling. Trust me, most people don't watch that. But I rarely watch ESPN. I don't watch SportsCenter. There are very few games on ESPN. I don't give a damn about ESPN. That's a big channel, and people pay a lot of money for it, whether they want to or not. And so you're talking about like little, the Ovation channel and tiny little channels, the Learning channel. You know what? ESPN's in trouble, because suddenly they're not going to have 100 million homes that are forced to pay $6 a month for ESPN, and a lot of people don't want it.
Well, think about it this way. Think about the fact that in, what was it, 2002, thereabouts, the Dodgers, after Los Angeles Dodgers baseball team, after how many umpteen decades, like 50, 60 decades of being in existence?
50, 60 years, perhaps.
Sorry. Yes, years. They were sold for like $500 million.
A gazillion dollars, to be exact.
$500 million. Okay.
A gazillion, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, $500 million. Now, that was 2002. Then 10 years later, so it took them like 60 years to get to $500 million. 10 years later, they're being sold for $2.7 billion. So what happened in that time frame? What happened is you had sports channels become so valuable because you are paying $6 per month, whether you want them or not. If you had that programming.
Well, ESPN is the one that gets that rate. The regional sports networks don't get that
same
amount.
They're getting 3 to 5,
but the YES Network is very valuable, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what happened there. And I think if that happens, you're going to see the value of these teams plummet. So it'll be interesting. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. So I think you're talking at least a 10-year time frame.
Yeah, no, it's going to have a big impact. Look at the YES Network. This is the channel that carries Yankee games. It's owned by the Yankee organization. Their daily average, because they have, of course, 24 hours a day to fill, they're a new peak, a new high of 27,000 people per day.
Oh, wow. That's amazingly low, actually.
Yeah, because people only tune in for the games.
Yes, that's true.
You know, and a lot of people don't, because they're Mets fans or they don't give a damn about baseball. So, again, that valuation is also probably wildly inflated. But, again, I'm more of the thing, you know, you networks need to figure out a way to make sure your channels are available on a dime and your shows are available on a dime, so that when people want to sample your show, it's really, really easy for them to get it on whatever services they're using. Because you want to make sure the ability to say, yeah, I want to check that show out. You don't want to have to go through hoops to do that. And it's right now, if this all happens and it all breaks up into little chunks, it's going to be jumping through hoops to get access to a show, and you're just not going to bother. And then suddenly the next Duck Dynasty, the next Mad Men, the next, you know, whatever, is not going to happen that easily.
Well, and then soon it won't matter whether it's on a network or not, because, you know, it'll just be, you know, Apple's.
Yeah, but you have to subscribe to Apple. You have to subscribe to Dish. Or you have to subscribe to Sony PlayStation. And if you're not on the right service, maybe you don't have that channel part of your package. And so the ability to add a channel just for a week or a day or a month, it's going to have to be a lot easier and a lot cheaper and simpler.
Well, much so like if you're on Amazon Prime and you don't have Netflix, okay? Well, first of all, we should mention some of these services aren't available outside of North America at all. But if you're on Amazon Prime here in the U.S., you might not be on Netflix, and therefore you don't get the House of Cards. It's subscribing to HBO.
Nobody gets it forget Amazon Prime. Unless you're on Netflix, you don't get House of Cards or Orange is the New Black. You know, and if you're not on Amazon, you don't get Transparent. Yeah, I mean, those shows are exclusive, so you have to buy that service, and there's no way to sample it otherwise. But it's going to be harder and harder when all the channels break apart, and there is no sort of base like cable that people can find 95% of all the hot new shows and sample, say, oh, Jamie Oliver on cooking, you know, I'll check that out. You know, whatever it might be, those casual discoveries of new shows will become a lot harder.
Well, now let's go take a step or take a look backwards for just a moment to net neutrality. Okay, because I want to point something out. You might be asking, why the heck are these guys talking about net neutrality all the time? Well, guess what? If you're watching most of your television via IPTV, which is what this is effectively, is IPTV.
What does that mean?
Internet Protocol Television. So it's basically the IP.
You mean over the internet?
Over the internet.
Tubes?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're getting your television and your streaming video content via the internet. Well, then all of a sudden, being able to charge those who are delivering the content, the Netflixes, the Amazons, being able to charge them a little bit more to stream into homes is very valuable. Well, that's what the FCC was trying to prevent and with their recently released rules. However, these cable providers who are still, they're the ones providing the internet access to the public internet. Okay, so they are actually saying, the FCC is saying you can't slow down data on the public internet. What you can do, however, you can put data caps in place. So if you put in some unrealistic data cap, like 250 gigabytes per month, well, okay, so you can watch 5 movies and 2 TV shows, and then that's it. And then you have to pay more. Or what would wind up happening is the Comcast, the Time Warners of the world, would turn around and say, well, why don't we start what's called zero rating some of these services? So they'll, you know, not Spotify, Netflix or Amazon Prime might come to Comcast and say, look, we'll pay you a certain fee to zero rate us, meaning that the data we send to your customers won't count against their data cap. So once again, this would be allowing cable companies and internet service providers to double dip. Charge the customer for providing internet service and charge for the delivery of the content. They could also create what's kind of known as a private internet, where you still have access to the public internet, but you get the premium stuff over on this private network where there's no data caps and you don't have to worry about all that stuff. And you get all of the juicy stuff, like, hey, maybe they'll bundle Amazon Prime and Netflix and HBO and all. You wind up with bundling again, basically. By the way, an example of private internet is called cable television.
So, right. So in sum, you may get rid of your cable package and go for one of these services. But guess what? Your internet bill is just about to go up.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Because you're paying for it ad hoc. Although I guess what Richard Greenfield says, and this is where I kind of agree with him, is if you really don't want to pay for ESPN, it really is about kind of empowering you to build that content product that you want.
But if you find out it doesn't save you any money, you might say, fine, I'll take the package with ESPN. If it's $5 less a month, why the hell do I care about, I'll get 700 channels and pay $10 less a month, or I empower myself and get 40 channels and pay more. Is that really what you think is going to happen? You're going to pay more to get fewer channels? Does that sound like a good idea?
I think it's all cyclical. I think just like with music, 10,000 songs, 100,000 songs. Spotify gives you access to every album ever. This is amazing. I can build all my own playlists. And then you realize, I don't want to build my own playlists. I need radio.
So in sum, you're going to have fewer channels and pay the same amount of money, if not more, especially when you count your Wi-Fi bill.
That is correct.
Although, no, your internet bill, I guess, not Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that's because the Wi-Fi is your protocol and yeah.
Okay, so that's
right.
Big. All right.
Yeah, I mean, look,
big, messy story. Let's move on.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about this forever. In fact,
we already have.
But let's talk about listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We have an anonymous email. Okay,
who's it from?
We're not allowed to. It's from somebody named Anon Y Mus.
So it's Edward Snowden.
Yes. Edward Snowden has contacted us through somebody named Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he writes, do you want to read this? You want me to read it?
Well, tell us what it says. It's from someone in Australia, you say, right?
I'm assuming it is, because this is what's written. Hello, guys. Got some rumors. The word is that Paramount is trying to lift policy from 55 to 60% of grosses, i.e. 5% more across the policy ladder, first week 60, second 55, etc.
Now, stop right there.
Pause. I'm going to. Yeah.
What the heck are you talking about?
Okay. So this is obviously somebody who works looks like in the film industry, and it looks like probably on the theatrical side, and meaning movie theaters. And they are, it looks like Paramount, a movie studio, is trying to lift the film rental rates that they get from movie theaters from 55 to 60%.
Well, now I thought, I didn't know any studio got more than 50% anywhere in the world.
Oh, they most certainly do. Depends on the territory. Now, what has been happening in the U.S., it used to be 76, what used to be called 70 down, 70, 60, 50, 40. So first,
meaning for opening weekend, the studio would get most of the money, like say 70%. And then the second week, it would get to 60% and then 50%. And then it would eventually plateau out. But they would get a lot of the money on opening weekend.
Right.
Right.
And then 70 was
so
really.
So if a movie had a long run, that benefited the theater chain.
That's right, because toward the end, you know, 6 weeks out, you're at 35%. So as the studio, you're getting 35%. The exhibitor's doing really well. So a movie like Frozen, why do you think it played so long? Well, except for the fact that Frozen, they don't do that anymore. Okay, so Disney, for instance, is on an aggregate, and it's on a floating aggregate. And what that means is they'll say, well, for Frozen, we're doing a 53% for you. So you'll negotiate like 53, 54%. For
right.
All,
so that means for the entire run of the movie, the studio gets 53%.
Right, which you might think, well, geez, 6 weeks out, that's going to be a pain in the neck. Yeah, but for the first weekend, when you think everybody's going to show up, you're not paying 65. You're not paying 60.
Well, what's the pain? It's not a pain. It seems perfectly reasonable. I mean, they had to adjust to the fact that, hey, movies were opening huge on opening weekend, and then by the fourth, fifth weekend, they weren't making any money. So theater chains were saying, hey, the weekend where you take the most money is where we're making all our grosses, and now we're getting left out in the cold. So they had to adjust. And it's better for everybody if you don't have like this wangling over week-to-week grosses and just say, hey, look, this is what we'll take of the cut.
Right. And there's always going back to what's called settle. So afterwards you say, hey, yeah, you said you were going to take 65% of some big movie like Jupiter Ascending, and it did horrible.
How about 50%?
Yeah, exactly.
Or, so now that's just North America.
That's North America and in other territories, except there are laws in other territories which, you know, kind of makes things bounce around a little bit. In North America, this floating aggregate also, they'll say, well, look, it's 55% if it hits $100 million in X amount of time. However, if it hits that in Y amount of time, then it's 70%, you know, whatever the percentage might be. So it's...
Oh, I thought it would be more like if a movie hits a certain target, we're going to get this money. If it's less than $100 million, maybe we only get
that's
where that, you know.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. That's exactly what I'm trying
so
to
do. So now I'm confused because I thought overseas that the studios were getting less money. We've been hearing about like 25% in China, 30% in, I think, the UK, and all these other territories where the studios that are, you know, getting the movies into these territories are not making the 50% that is sort of our rule of thumb for North America.
It depends on the territory. And
but worldwide, we constantly talk about how, yeah, but overseas grosses, you're not getting nearly as much as you would in the U.S. That's just a truism that we've been saying for a long time. Are you saying that's not the case? Because you're saying in Australia, the studios get like 60%.
Australia is an English-speaking territory, so yes, they often do get 50% in Australia. I'm not talking about China. I'm not talking about Thailand. I'm not talking about the U.K. in Australia.
Australia? I'm pretty sure the U.K. speaks English, too.
Yes, and but there are different laws in the UK which prevent.
So worldwide,
things.
When we're looking at grosses overseas, what's the general rule of thumb the studios use? That they're going to pull back 30% of the income or 40%? Or what do they end up pulling, essentially, assuming it's a usual mix of
35 to 40% if you average it all out.
Okay. And so that's less than they're getting in the U.S. So now they're trying to raise that total. And they seem to be starting with a territory where they're already getting more than they do in the U.S.
Yes. And in the U.S., it's edged up to about 51, 52, 53%.
All right. So what else does this guy or woman say? I shouldn't say guy. We don't know. What else does this person say?
Well, he continues, as you can imagine.
He? You don't know that.
Okay. As this person says, as you can imagine, it's a hot topic.
You're sexist.
As you would, that by the way was not part of the letter. As you would expect, if one distributor does this, they will all follow. That right there is not necessarily true because they're not allowed to speak to one another about this.
No, they're not. But once they find out that somebody else is getting more money, they're going to want more money too. Of course, I think this person's right.
Well,
and not that it's collusive, but just hey, when they find out somebody's renegotiating, got more money, then they're going to want more money too.
And it will also depend on the actual film. You know, if the film they really want you to play.
Don't they make a new contract for every single stupid movie?
Yes, although they're, 20th Century Fox always, you know, they have a standing contract. So, yeah. And then they work from there. So you know what the standing contract is, and then, you know.
But when
know,
it's Star Wars, they say we want more money.
Right.
Okay. And this person says this is a worldwide play. It's not just Australia. They're hearing that Paramount wants more money from every territory. Why wouldn't they?
Right. And that, unfortunately, in Australia, movie going is really suffered, and at least one exhibitor has had to lower prices from $20 to $19 per ticket.
Had to lower prices. They should $20 to see a movie. Yeah, it's a lot in the UK as well. It's a very expensive to go to the movies.
And he goes on to say, this is what I think is funny. He says, but there is also talk of massive exhibition, quote unquote, funny business going on as distributors are investigating the methods of how the bigger chains are selling tickets. For example, bundling items with tickets, but making the extra item worth a huge amount and leaving the distributors getting 55% of a much smaller number.
So you get like the ticket plus a CD, but the CD costs $15 and the ticket costs $5.
Right.
So that's the idea. Okay.
Yeah. This and other tricks. Independents are also not looking very clean, meaning the independent theater owners. It is also felt that the industry, due to the environment, has basically made it an industry of cheats, as studios are the only ones doing well. Funny business is becoming the norm in Australia, and probably other parts of the world I would not know, but I hear comments like, how can he keep open with such low numbers from one cinema owner looking at Rentrak? That's one cinema owner looking at the Rentrak numbers and saying, how is this theater grossing so little and it's still open?
Huh,
they should
okay.
be closed. It was also rumored a number of years ago how one large cinema chain had software written to allow inputting numbers from their ticketing system, then outputting fudged numbers, i.e. moving heads from full price tickets to other categories, etc., reduce numbers within our, you know, so basically, you know.
Cheating. Yeah, saying, oh, with senior tickets rather than a full yeah. price adult.
It appears that over here, distributors don't really care to chase down independents too much as it's too much trouble. They mainly focus on larger chains. That's true almost everywhere. However, the lack of enforcement over such a long time, it's getting a little extreme. I am surprised the studios put up with it. Here's the deal. They absolutely know that this is going on. This whole, like, the whole thing about, and this, I'm speaking as somebody who has had to develop software for this space.
To try and catch this stuff or make sure these finagling doesn't happen?
I didn't write it myself, but I had to develop software that allowed theater owners to operate. So it was their enterprise systems, internal systems, that had to have two different numbers for the same theater. So yes, they know that the game is played a certain way, and they're constantly lying to one another. If you go over to Celluloid Junkie, you'll find some really good stuff Patrick Von Sikofsky has written on what's going on in China regarding this.
Well, that's where we usually hear about, like, oh, the numbers are fake, but I wouldn't expect in France and the UK and Australia that you'd be seeing this sort of widespread corruption.
It depends on the territory. For instance, in Hungary, it's very difficult to do this. Why? Because there are two registers, and when you actually buy a ticket, there's two receipts that are generated. One, which goes to the
it's like a voting thing?
Yeah, it goes to the tax office, and one for you. So the tax office knows exactly how much was sold. So
it's like voting when you have a paper trail,
yeah,
and you can
exactly.
actually see how they voted. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, but this whole, and I can't tell you the number of distributors who they know exactly which.
Japan? Is there corruption in Japan?
That I don't know.
Germany?
Germany
Spain?
And France, they have different rules and regulations. Spain, I would not doubt it, actually.
Mm-hmm. What about the U.S.? Why not the U.S.?
Oh, the U.S. is definitely there. They have, in the U.S., they have what are called checkers that go in and actually do headcounts for certain shows. So that when they get the box office report back, they go, yeah, no, there were, you know, 150 people there. And
well, how much does the fact that they're doing that mean the corruption doesn't happen? Or does that mean that they're catching people and prosecuting them? What's going on?
Well, they don't prosecute. What they do is they do audits.
Catching a theater chain breaking, you know, lying.
Oh,
then it's a
lawsuit. Yes.
Right. So yeah. the oversight is keeping that from happening as much here
as
in the
much,
U.S.
Yes.
I would have thought with credit cards and stuff, it'd be a lot harder to fudge this stuff.
It absolutely is. And in fact, what the studios have done is they have gone to what's called a per capita. So you actually have to pay per ticket per capita. They kind of look in an area and they say per capita tickets should cost, a movie ticket should cost $7 in this area. at 7 p.m. So therefore, if you report 100 tickets were sold at $6, that means you're discounting them, which means you owe us a dollar for every ticket you sold. So
I don't understand that at all.
They're trying to stop the deep discounting.
If people are paying by credit card, it's got to be a lot harder for the theater chains to hide the money.
Oh, it absolutely
and
is.
And to hide the individual sales.
It absolutely
so
is.
So why, if that's the case, I'm assuming that in developed countries that ticket sales are being done by credit card the vast majority of the time now. I would have imagined 70%, 80% of sales are tickets, credit.
I can't speak to that.
If not higher, I mean, well, yeah, but surely you understand. When was the last time you took cash to buy movie tickets? You know, I would think it happens a lot more often with credit cards, especially because it's so expensive. So I don't understand why all this finagling is happening if it's going to be harder to hide it when you're using a Visa.
Well, because you are getting the numbers from the fox who is guarding the hen house. So you're getting the numbers from the exhibitor saying, yeah, 10 people showed up for your...
So we have two things. We have corruption and we have a studio wanting to get a bigger cut of the grosses. The bigger cut of the grosses, of course, is an eternal truth.
Yes.
But is there a sense that there is a big push from the major studios to try and renegotiate and get bigger cuts of the pie around the world? Are you hearing about like there's a big push on, or is it just normal business?
This is just normal business.
All right. But the corruption is new to me.
The corruption is kind of always it's corruption as much as corner cutting.
It's not corner cutting, it's corruption. If you're lying and saying you sold a senior ticket when you sold a full price ticket, that's corruption. That's lying. That's stealing. It's not, you know, corner cutting. It's fraud. It's theft. They should be in jail.
That's gone on time immemorium in the exhibition.
That's okay.
Business.
They should still be in jail. Well, that we appreciate them writing. That was certainly nice of them. Whoever they are, we'll keep it secret. Nobody tell.
Well, we don't know. So
that's right.
That's going to be a hard. But you know what? If you have, you know, an anonymous tip or even a tip that you'd like to be credited for, please feel free to write us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is our voicemail. That's 888-567-7263. You can also reach out to us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. You can like us on Facebook, where our page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. Please do rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators, or if you have a podcast app on your phone, subscribe to the show there. It really does help us out when you subscribe and rate and review the show.
You haven't done it yet.
Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways, all those ways to contact us, subscribe to us, follow us, like us, stalk us, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
It's cookieforpresident.com.
Oh my goodness, I have a feeling that somehow relates to Empire, a show which I waited until the last episode to air so I could watch the entire season at once. And if you can't find Michael on cookieforpresident.com, why not try michaelgiltz.com or head on over to the Huffington Post to read some of his writing on the entertainment industry, or as he mentioned, bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.